anechoic chamber, which is located at Edwards Air Force Base. It's called the Benefield Anechoic Facility of the Air Force. I wanted to measure what was the quality of that chamber. And if the chamber was working very well, you send a pulse from the center of the room toward one of the absorbing walls that had these great big pyramids of urethane foam with resistive loading particles inside, made by Emerson Cumming, absorber material. If the absorber material was doing its job correctly, the pulse of RF energy you send to the wall would be absorbed and not come back to you. And any imperfection in the wall or the floor or the instrumentation you had in the room would give you an echo. So I was doing spatial time domain reflectometry in that chamber. And I won some awards for doing that. I was literally building a radar. That's what it really was. It was a radar inside the chamber that could resolve a range of a nearest quarter of a foot. I was using quarter nanosecond pulses. So 3 or 4 inches in range, I could resolve whether or not there was an echoing device, somewhat like when you were doing it inside the cable and looking at your connectors. And it was a real fun project. I could find every nail and every adapter that somebody had dropped into the absorbing material on the floor by aiming a high-gain antenna around the room and looking for those echoes with spatial time domain reflectometry. Let me drop one more time. Now, the flashlight and the high-gain antenna that I use to aim around this great... Wait to the beep. The flashlight that I used to aim around this room to look for the echoes with the high-gain antenna just happened to be something that was mounted in the middle of the room, a full-size aircraft, a B-1B bomber, the high-gain transmitting antenna on the aircraft is what I used as the flashlight, and it was mounted on a huge turntable. I guess the turntable was something like 50 feet in diameter, maybe it was 40 feet in diameter, and it would turn the whole darn aircraft, and I was looking at the echoes as I aimed that great big flashlight, so to speak, around this room, which was 300 foot square and 70 foot high. So, as you can tell, Ed, I've done some time domain reflectometry. You've seen it, and it's a fun machine. I'm very disappointed that I don't see those at flea markets. They're kind of rare. When people get a hold of them, they hold on to them. Back to you for any other comments, Ed. And the blackness that you see, which I think is silver sulfide, is itself a good conductor. And with the wiping you're describing, looks to me like everything's going very well.
Wesley, comment.
Make sure you wait for the beep. And before I turn it back to Ed, Wesley wants to make a comment. Wait for the beep, and you got it, Wesley.
Okay, this is November to X-ray, Juliet November. There was a word that was used, corrosion. It's actually oxidation, it's not a corrosion. And the first thing that I was taught in Army, as an engineer, was never clean it up. Corrosion is destructive, oxidation is actually protective. As it was mentioned, the connector does not get black inside, they go black outside. It does work better, especially outside on the rain and different temperature, when it has a oxidation on it. And as far as the school, well, the first requirement in the Army, Communist Army at that time, was memorize so many things. And one of the things that I memorized so many years ago was the prefixes of the measurements. And this is tera, giga, mega, kilo, hecta, deca, decicenti, milli, micro, nano, pico, femto, anto. Would you be able to repeat that, Dick, and to exam?
Okay, EY.
Mel recognized. One of the things that I've often done, Wesley, I've had a lot of friends with my friends, as I'll ask them how many nano kilo megabucks are in their pocket. and you go through the calculation, you find out a nano, kilo, megabuck is $1. And then I tell them, well, I don't deal in small amounts of money. I measure my money in mega, mega, pico dollars. Now, when you read the books from the National Bureau of Standards, they tell you you're not supposed to be combining the units in that manner. But kilo, mega, giga, tera, and so on. Those are 10 to the 3, 10 to the 6, 10 to the 9, 10 to the 12. And they go all the way up to 10 to the 24. And when it comes to things being smaller, milli, micro, nano, pico, femto, atto, I just gave you 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the minus 12, 10 to the minus 15, 10 to the minus 18. Learning those units is a very valuable thing to do. And that's what I think Wesley is reteaching me. Let's see what Mel's got to say about all this. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Now, I salvaged a lot, to say the least, from World War II equipment, a lot of cable. I cut off PL-59s, a lot of box floats, CNCs, and all the cable, of course, was all dried out, shot through, it all lay in warehouses, and they were throwing out the cable, tons of it, and I thought, gee, all PL-259, beautiful connectors on them, you know, that was in World War II, high quality stuff. So I just cut the cables off, took them, and to salvage the connectors, all I did is with a small torch, I would pull the center out, heat the center, pull the center out, and heat it a little more around the edge, pull the shield out, and then take these connectors and using a wire brush, a rotary wire brush, a very soft one, wire brush, for polishing metal and all, light one. I polish those connectors up just to make them look beautiful, I do, and salvaged all those connectors. They all look like I say, just a purchase from Amazon. So that's the way you salvage those connectors. As far as the TDR, I use that thing every day. I have a AEA TDR and graphics display and VIX. It's amazing what a that little instrument put out by AEA, yet don't publicize as much can do. Over.
Glad to hear you've got a TDR. And in the amateur equipment that most of us own, that's a fairly rare instrument. But I'm going to agree with Wesley on this thing, and that is when we try to make a connector look more pretty by polishing it, you really are artificially aging it. You're taking away some of the very thin, valuable coating that's on the interfacing contacts of the connector. That silver plating is usually not very thick, or the gold plating, because silver and gold are expensive materials, and you don't want to abrade them in order to polish them up to make them look good to your eye. And if you know what you're looking at, the blackness on silver, which is usually silver sulfide, is in itself a very good conductor, even though it doesn't look pretty. So leaving it alone, worrying about corrosion, yes, but when it comes to oxidation with the right kind of materials is not necessarily bad. So the cleaning process that you described to make them look pretty could be taking away some of that valuable coating and artificially aging the connector a little bit. You didn't do anything bad, but Wesley's recommending we don't do it, and I think I'm going to agree with him. So looks like you've asked us a pretty interesting set of questions here, Ed. You can tell we got a little bit off subject, but I think it's educational. K2GJE for any other comments. K2RIW in the TechNet. K2YO. Bernie recognized, but Ed first. Go ahead, Ed.
Okay, I'm just waiting for the drop. I have two questions and one comment, and then I'll let you continue with other people. What is the timeout time on this repeater, and can I input it from the 375 repeater? And my comment, I think I was listening about 2 weeks ago. You were talking about antennas in a tunnel. Going back to the 60s, I was involved with the antenna that ran, I think, from Bowling Green, Manhattan, to J Street, Brooklyn, that ran through the tunnel. And that was not a lossy coax. That was an antenna that looked like very sturdy 600-ohm cable. I wish I had some of it. If you cut it, it would look like a figure eight, and the conductors were like either 6 or 8 gauge wire. Very substantial stuff, and they hung it about every 10 feet or so. They had some kind of hanger that they installed away from other cables, and still have clearance to the train. Just a comment. Back to net, and thank you for your information. Over.
Very fine, Ed. I think the best you can do is assume that the timing on this repeater is 60 seconds. It might be 90 seconds, but assume it to be 60, and we should all interrupt our conversation every 60 and wait to get a real good beep, which takes about 4 seconds. Your second question, can you be inputting to the 147.375 machine, which is also a Limonk machine, connected to this one? Absolutely. I'm hearing you dead full quieting 60 dB over 9 on my input, so I can tell you're closer to the so-called Eastern input, 0.375. You can definitely be talking through that one. That's the good news. The bad news is that up till now, the 375 machine gets connected by way of an internet connection, kind of an IRLP or a Ethernet or, no, a I can't think of the name of it now, an Echo Link, but it's an internet connection. And sometimes the internet connection has got a quarter of a second delay, and sometimes it's got 3 seconds delay. So the extra delay to the Eastern input, and that delay usually works in both directions, sometimes that can create some confusion where people will pick up too soon before they pick up a person from the Eastern input. Eric and Andy are in the process of replacing that with another system, which will have a hell of a lot less delay. So that system is going to improve. So
that's not the comment.
Say that again?
The 900 megahertz linking will defeat the internet. As far as like these things go, we're going to stay with the IRLP because we have people all over the country that are coming into us which would be precluded by the 900 megahertz link.
Eric, is it possible for the 375 and the 85 machine to be connected by a 900 meg link so that between the machines there is very little delay, at the same time that they're also connected to a IRLP internet node as far as people out of the area? Could we get the best of both worlds? Is that possible? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, we could do that. We could do that. But the problem is that people will be too fast on the trigger, and being too fast on the trigger blows up the internet connection.
So even though the connection between the two machines will be fast, with the amount of delay you have on the beep right now, and if we all wait for that beep, and as long as we don't go beyond 60 seconds of timing of transmitting, I think you're good for 90 seconds, but if we all interrupt every 60 seconds, would we therefore be able to keep from timing out the internet connection? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, I could arrange that. Actually, the timing is right now, I think, is 100 seconds, I think I have it at this point. And, of course, we still blow it up because you need the 3.5 to 4 seconds between transmissions for everything to cycle back down. And that's just the nature of the IRLP system. And the TechNet is the only net that has the problem of blowing it up. People use it every day without issue. So, go figure.
Well, we're a real high-power, excited group. There are times we get into subjects that are hot and heavy, and dominates, Eric, and we override the timing and time out the machine. That's part of what's going on. This is an unruly group. This is a wild group. You know that. Now, the last question I've got for you, Bob, and that is the figure eight open wire line. I'm not quite sure what that means. Does that mean the open wire line had a twist in it so that it looks like a series of figure eights end to end? When it comes to sending a line down a tunnel to irrigate that tunnel with RF energy so that people walking down that tunnel or riding down that tunnel can talk with a handy talkie, and law enforcement and fire and police and whatever would love to be able to do that, and radiax is the way that it's frequently done today with other auxiliary antennas backing it up, what was different about this figure eight cable? Give me a couple of words on that. Was it open wire line with some kind of a twist to it? W2ILP. K2RIW. You got it, Bob.
I'm not the one who commented on the line, Dick. Someone else was talking about the line in the tunnel. This is Bob, W2ILP. Back to you, Dick.
Sorry about that, Bob. I read the name wrong name off my list. I meant Ed. K2GJE. Go right ahead, Ed.
No, the line was not twisted. The plastic material, it was a gray plastic. If you cut the cable, it looked like straight. In other words, there was more plastic around each conductor as opposed to the spacing between the two conductors. And it was like open wire line. It was not coax. As a matter of fact, in the several areas where it came to the end of a tunnel and the train came out into the open, they would put an antenna there, over.
Comment.
Okay, I've now got the picture. That when you cut it and look down the end of it, you saw the two wires of the twin lead. Around each wire is a thick piece of plastic with a bone of plastic, so to speak, between the two, and it looked like a figure eight. I understand. Now, Wesley recognized, but first, Ed, were you aware that this cable was intended to have a certain amount of spacing between the wires so that it was supposed to have a certain amount of continuous radiation along its length? Was that the figure eight cable used just as a low-loss transmission line to go from point A to point B, or was it supposed to be leaking a small amount of signal along the length so that intermediate points of communication could take place? What do you think was the method it was being used, Ed? K2GJE, K2RIW in the DECnet.
The cable was supposed to be leaking RF so that there was continuous two-way traffic between the moving train and a central station in Brooklyn while the train was even in motion. You could also contact this cable if you had something like an HT. Over.
Very interesting. Now, radiax cable, which really is coaxial cable with periodic holes, oblong holes, in the outer conductor, so that it continuously radiates, and twin lead of or open wire line with just the right spacing for that particular wavelength in use will also give you a continuous leakage. The advantage of radiax coaxial cable is that it's much more friendly in the way you can mount it to the wall of a tunnel. You can use metal clamps to hold it to the wall, and maybe with a rubber insert to make sure you don't damage the cable. Whereas with twin lead, with open wire line, it takes a more elaborate kind of dielectric suspension structure. These standoff insulators that used to be used for television twin lead installation, I am guessing something similar to that was required for this open wire figure eight line. I'm going to pass that back to you, Ed, for an answer on that. And the disadvantage of using a standoff insulator made out of dielectric materials is that dielectric materials tend to deteriorate in time, and the cable will drop to the floor, whereas a metal clamp holding radiax to the wall is considerably more substantial. K2GJE, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2GJE. I was involved in this project in, I'm trying to think now, it probably was the mid-60s. I don't know what New York City Transit Authority uses now through the tunnels. I don't fully remember what the standoff was, whether it was metal or phenolic or some other insulator. I can't see personally having a metal clamp on this twin lead. That doesn't sound right to me either. So I assume they had possibly some insulating material at the end of this hangar, which they stood the cable off the wall, if I remember, like roughly about 10 inches or so. It varied where there, you know, where there was clearance, and through some of the tunnels, there wasn't that much clearance between the train and the bore of the tunnel over.
Comment.
Understand. So, yeah, I can see why the more modern radiax is being used. N2XJN, K2RIW.
K2RIW group on the TechNet N2XJN. There was a first concept that was very much known. One of the wire was thicker than the other. Then the wire was, for the frequency that was used in Europe, was 170 to 220. And the spacing between the wall of the tunnel and the wire was very much critical. Now, why was that? I do not know, but I've read the specification. It was 7 centimeters. 7 centimeters. Now, the wire was hung on the metal bracket, but the part that was actually around the wire was plastic. And that metal was actually melted into that plastic holder. Another thing, let me jump for a moment. It was a first coaxial cable. I know you're going to object, but look how the first coaxial cables, leaking coaxial cables, were made. They were cut, not having a hose at a certain distance between themselves, but they were cut. There was the wire that was inside, and there was the outer coat that has a gap, horizontal gap on it. Now this actually thing that looks like number 8, it was a one thicker wire and one wire that was smaller in diameter. One of the wires was connected to the ground. The other wire served as an active antenna. Do you see much difference between coaxial cable, leaking coaxial cable, and this? Back to you again, to XJM.
Hey, RFN, a question.
RFN recognized. We'll get to you after Bernie, because Bernie's waiting to also make comments. Whether you use it with unequal-sized wires on the open wire line, and one of them you declare to be the ground or return or counterpoise and the other one live, it is the open wire line equivalent of microstrip transmission line. Very similar. There's nothing magic about transmission line having equal diameters on open wire line. There's advantages and disadvantages. And when it comes to coaxial cable, there's nothing magic about the outer conductor and the inner conductor being perfectly ground. They can be square rectangular, oval. There's nothing magic about the semiconductor of coax cable being concentric with the outer conductor. It can be off to one side. You'd be amazed how many ways you can make transmission line. There's probably 15 different kinds of transmission line when you include thin line and triplate strip line, microstrip, coplanar waveguide, coplanar waveguide with ground plane, all the kinds of coaxial cable, symmetric and non-symmetric, and various shapes of the conductors, and open wire line with various shapes and diameters and spacings of the conductors and variations in their sizes. If you know what you're doing, lots and lots of ways of making a transmission line. And to make one that has a controlled amount of leakage by various techniques of cutting the outer conductor of coaxial or adjusting for the spacing between open wire line, let me drop. If you make the spacing for the open wire line very, very small compared to a wavelength, it will not radiate. The three conductors that you see in a triangular pattern for high voltage transmission lines, the 130 kilovolt lines, three phase on these great big towers going across the United States, that is a beautifully shielded transmission system, believe it or not. Even though you see 10 feet of spacing between each of those wires, when the frequency is as low as 60 cycles, as long as the current is equal on those three lines, the A, B, and C phase, that is a very well-shielded system. Very little electrostatic field or very little magnetic field leaks out of that high-voltage transmission system. The distribution systems going up and down the blocks, quite often they don't obey those rules quite as well, and a little more radiation comes out of those. Let's see, now Bernie has been standing by and wanting to make a comment. K2 Yankee Oscar. Make sure you wait for the beep. K2RAW. You got it, Bernie.
Good evening, Dick and Jeanette. I'll apologize now for the bad signal. I was just going to comment on the TDR part of the conversation. Most cable installers in the computer world now are carrying TDR members as part of their, or TDR meters as part of their toolkit to measure network cables.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. Many of the instruments that people use these days, particularly vector network analyzers, are now becoming very popular along with spectrum analyzers and service monitors and communication test sets. Many of them have the equivalent or actual time domain reflectometry built in. You can either do time domain reflectometry in the brute force manner, which means you initiate extremely brief pulses or an extremely brief transition of voltage, a step.
County for the machine is a nice idea. Daily.
Shut up.
Not quite sure what that was. So you can either make an extremely brief transition or really brief pulses with your instrumentation to create time domain reflectometry. There is a Fourier transform equivalent of time domain reflectometry. If you program your vector network analyzer to measure either transmission or reflection characteristics on a large number of frequencies, usually 2 to the n frequencies, like 512 or 1024 or 2048 individual frequencies, you measure amplitude or phase of either S11, reflection coefficient, or S21, forward transmission characteristics, take that data set, apply it to the right kind of a Fourier transform-like program, which is called the Steinhelfer technique, invented by Mr. Steinhelfer in 1968, and out comes the equivalent of a time domain reflectometry test, which in many cases is synthesizing a brief pulse many times faster or more brief than you could really make in reality. I personally worked on sub-nanosecond high-power pulsing techniques, and that in itself is an art form. A sampling head on a vector network analyzer, in many cases, is taking samples with pulse durations of a few picoseconds. A picosecond is 10 to the minus 12 seconds. That's fast. In one picosecond, let me drop. In one picosecond, at the speed of light, a signal at 186,000 miles per second only moves a tenth of an inch. So, if you can make a pulse a picosecond long, that pulse only moves a little bit more than a tenth of an inch during your pulse. And that gives you the capability of some very high resolution time domain reflectometry to look at your transmission section system, look at its interruptions of its connectors, see the reflection from the antenna. If you know what you're looking at, that can give you a lot of valuable information. KC2RFN, I think I heard, Kilo Charlie 2, it sounded like Romeo Foxtrot November, but I think I got that wrong. Please correct me, tell me your call letters, and I think you wanted to make a comment. Go right ahead, K2RIW, my name is Dick, wait for the beep.
I think you are correct, it is KC2RFN, you are correct. My question actually leads, as it to a comment as well. I was wondering if you knew anything about these new full-body scanners at the airport, and if you knew those were dangerous or not, or what the basic mechanism is to how they work. My name is Alan, KC2RFN, and my name is Alan.
Alan, give me your call letters one more time. It sounds like you're saying Kilo Charlie 2, Romeo Foxtrot November. That's what it sounds like you're saying. But according to the QRZ.com, that's not recognized as a current license. Over to you, Alan.
It is KC2RFN. I'm in QRZ. I am online there. KC2RFN is correct.
Is that Romeo Foxtrot November? Or Romeo Foxtrot Mike?
Romeo Foxtrot November. Romeo Foxtrot November.
LH2RYY.
Yeah, give me a comment on that one, Joe. QRZ.com says that it is not a set of call letters. Over to you, Joe.
I was out of range before. I heard you call for me, but I was out of range and I couldn't check back in. Programmable Zener diodes.
Okay, we'll get back to you. Alan, when it comes to the scanners, let me drop to make sure I get a beep. When it comes to the scanners that are used in airports, don't worry. You've got a lot of federal agencies making sure that you're not subjecting your passengers to a dangerous condition. Many of the scanners are a simple magnetic detector looking for metallic objects. However, the more modern ones are a passive radiometry system. In other words, if you have a system that is sensitive enough, because your body is at room temperature, 300 degrees Kelvin, your body is continuously transmitting a broadband signal, an extremely weak broadband signal. So one of the systems that's being perfected, and I've done some work on these, is a passive, you could call it passive millimeter wave receiving system. It's a phased array antenna that does no transmitting. It simply listens to the black body radiation, it's called, the heat being radiated by your body. You could call it very, very far infrared emission from your body. And the nice thing about those systems is that they can easily see objects that you're wearing. In other words, if I wore a pocket knife, a spoon, a ceramic knife, the amount of temperature being emitted by that portion of my body would be different, and it would show up on the photograph, so to speak, the display that that machine makes. So if you're worried about the radiation, so to speak, of your inspection material by the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, I wouldn't worry. The worst thing I can think of is that there is a kind of a minor X-ray machine that does inspect your baggage. And depending on how critical your film is, there are people who worry about old-fashioned Kodak film, chemical film, being slightly fogged by that machine. I'm a little bit skeptical of that. I put my film through one of those in the old days and never had a problem. So these inspection machines are going to be getting better and better, and the really good ones are running in a thoroughly passive manner. They don't transmit any signal toward your body. Over to you, Alan. Kilo Charlie 2 Romeo Foxtrot November, question mark, K2RIW. My name is Dick. You got it, Alan.
Thank you, Dick. I didn't know it was a passive system. A lot of my friends ask me about it because they know I'm a little involved in radio and electronics, and I told them it seemed objectionable to me that they would be firing radar into us, but it's certainly good to hear that isn't happening. You do have my call sign correct. I'm on QRZ right now. Kilo Charlie 2, Romeo Foxtrot November is there. My name is Alan Feller. I've been on there for some time now, about 2 years. So maybe if you update your browser, maybe it'll pop up or there's some glitch. But I am there and I'm real, and I appreciate you answering my questions. Thank you, Ben. KC2RFN.
Very fine. Looks like I put it in incorrectly, and looks like I've created the problem. Sorry about that, Alan, and good luck. Now, when it comes to these passive imaging systems that are now being used by the TSA, the one thing that people worry about is that the picture you get of a human being done with a passive imaging system does not discriminate various portions of the body. You literally get a picture of the human being, not quite, but almost as if the person had no clothing on. And therefore, it does represent a bit of a privacy issue. For a short period of time, they were blocking out the portions of the human body which were, let's call it sensitive, the sex organs. Well, obvious by what happened with the so-called Christmas Day bomber, what he was originally called. Other people want to call him the underwear bomber. You don't want to block out that area. You want to look at everything. So I think the right solution is that you have a male operator looking at male passengers. You have a female operator looking at the image of female passengers that you get with that machine. That's my guess as to what the final solution is going to be. And you don't block out certain areas. Obvious by what that man was doing. He was trying to take advantage of the system, which he thought would be blocking out certain areas of his body. But the better systems are running thoroughly passively. There's a whole lot of advantages to that. Let's see, the next person who signed in, I guess, was Joe. It sounds like Joe is back, and he wants to talk about xenodiodes, I think. Xenodiodes, or also Schottky. No, let's call them xenos. You got it, Joe. W-E-2-R-Y-Y. KQRIW and TechNet. Make sure you wait for the beep. Sometimes I goof. Joe, did you go away again? I'm hearing both the eastern input and the western input. Okay. I'm going down my list. Before I go over to Paul to hear the latest in the space report, Have I made the mistake of skipping over anyone who signed in with a question or a comment? If so, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW and the TechNet. Okay. Paul, what's the latest in space? I think there was supposed to be a launch, but it got a weather delay of the space shuttle. I think we're getting down to the very last couple of launches. And I know that some of our other spacecraft out in space are starting to do some real good work of finding exoplanets, and eventually they're going to find Earth-sized planets going around other stars. WS2N, K2RIW on TechNet, and I think you've got a timer, but make sure you release the machine every 60 seconds or so. You've got it, Paul.
Well done. Very good. And, yeah, Dick, the shuttle was supposed to go off this morning, but that was definitely delayed. STS-130 was delayed because of low cloud cover. So they're going to wait until tomorrow morning to launch the shuttle. I think 4:15 or 4:30 or something in the morning is the scheduled launch. So we'll be anxious to see that thing get off. I won't go through too much of that. That's the one with the cupola on board, the window-like observatory that they're going to be looking for. New node, the Harmony node, or correction, Tranquility node. Harmony is the one that's up there, and the one before that is Unity. Any interconnecting devices that little like rooms with many ports on it, kind of like a round dice. You know, it's just every side has a 1 meter opening that you can attach something to, either a docking port or another module or like the Quest module, which is where they exit the space station if they want to do a spacewalk. So you could attach anything to it. And in this case, they're on the one side, they're attaching the cupola, and that's going to give them a 360-degree view of incoming and outgoing spacecraft and the view of Earth. It should be pretty cool. It's very practical, too. It's nice to visually see what's going on when you have these unmanned crafts approaching the station. Let me drop it. And this is WS2N. So that should be interesting. They've got three spacewalks planned. And yes, I think there's four. I believe this is number four. And then you've got three flights after that. That's about it. Maybe four. But this is the last of the big installation projects. The rest of them are more or less resupplying or bringing up big, heavy equipment, gigantic tanks and nitrogen tanks, huge things that will attach to the space station in case anything fails. They'll have backup. And at the end of the manned space program, and basically that's what they've done last week. On the 3rd of February, they made an announcement that they're canceling the Constellation program. So that's gone. Sad to say, but we are left with the robotic missions. And the observatories. You have another observatory going up this, this week, February 10th, aboard a big Atlas V rocket. And they call that the SDO, or the Solar Dynamics Observatory. And it's a mission really to study the sun. You know, that we've had things up there before where European Space Agency has put our spacecraft up to study the sun. We have the ACE spacecraft, a couple of others, but this one is quite large. It's large. If you're putting it on an Atlas V, you know, it's pretty big. Pretty. And, you know, it's got going to study the ultraviolet spectrum. Ultraviolet light is important because, you know, ultraviolet light is what heats up the outer atmosphere, expands the atmosphere, tends to deorbit spacecraft a little earlier than they should when we drop it. And you've got cameras on board that are probably twice as big as previous cameras that we've had up there before. And, you know, you'll be able to take pictures directly of the sun. Usually, all these other spacecraft that we've had, you get every, like, 3 minutes is about the fastest. You know, every 3 minutes you'll normally take a picture. This thing's going to take pictures every 10 seconds, so they'll be able to get an idea of what's going on, better detail from, you know, from time frame to time frame, and they'll have a better understanding of what's going on with the magnetic field and all these coronal, expulsions that they have. The sun blows like mountains full of ions and everything out every second. You know, they want to be able to see where this is going and maybe even predict a lot earlier when something like that is going to happen when you have a coronal mass ejection. If it heads toward the Earth, that's the thing that knocks out communications and even disrupts power grids on the Earth. On the internet, I saw, you know, a comparison between, you know, the older cameras and the newer cameras. This thing has a 16 megapixel capability, so it should be pretty good. And that's pretty much it for that, Dick. I really don't have that much more. Just the shuttle. SDO, you know, the SDO mission, the Solar Dynamics Observatory for the 10th, and the basically the end of the manned space program, as far as I'm concerned, with nothing planned down in the future, except maybe private corporations or, you know, companies taking up the slack and trying to launch their own people into space. And we still have the capability. I mean, we have the equipment. You've got the Delta IV rocket that's capable of putting people in Earth, although, you know, we've never done it with that. Now we have the Atlas V, the one that's launching this observatory. We've launched that a couple of times, very successful. And that also has the capability of carrying that kind of payload to put people up there. But there's no plan on using any of it for that purpose. But back to you, Dick. This is WS2N.
Yeah, sounds to me like they're going to attempt to make a launch tomorrow. And whenever they launch on the second day, I always worry a little bit. Because you've now had the cryogenic materials in the external tank for a longer period of time, giving a greater opportunity for ice to be built up on the insulation on the outside of that tank. And we know from past experience that when a chunk of ice and that foam breaks off from the external tank, if it falls the wrong way and hits the leading edge of the wing of the space shuttle, it can create grief, obvious by what happened in the Columbia incident. And I think it was also a second day launch that took place with the... Yes, it was a second day launch that took place on the... space shuttle that had Krista McAuliffe way back in 1985. All of a sudden I can't think of the name of that Challenger, the Challenger incident. So second day launches to me are always a little bit more risky. Too bad there isn't some way they can put a heater on the outside of the external tank to stop it from forming ice build up, ice and or liquid air. Turns out the temperatures at which liquid oxygen and liquid nitrogen are loaded into those tanks, those temperatures will when come in contact with air, will liquefy the air. It's hard to believe. It doesn't make ice out of the air, but it makes liquid out of the air. But the moisture that's in the air also forms into ice, a kind of condensation, very similar to what happens on the freezer section of your old-fashioned refrigerator. You get an ice buildup. I don't know if I have any other further questions. Only a couple launches left. It's a little bit disappointing. Let me drop. I hope Alan is still with us. Kate C2RFN. Kilo Charlie 2, Romeo, Foxtrot November. Alan, Dr. Feller, are you still with us? Go ahead.
WA2YYY. You keep on timing out my node.
Yes, I'm here, Dick. KC2RFN.
I'm waiting for the beep each time, so I'm not quite sure how we're timing out the node, but I'm going to go over to you in a minute, Joe. Hey, let me apologize to you. I must have been doing something very wrong in the way I was loading your call letters into my computer. And you've got a very nice website. And I can tell you and I had a face-to-face meeting at the We had a face-to-face meeting at the Ham Radio University. And that's a crazy picture you got at the end of your website. Well done. And so you can see a picture of some interesting people when you go to QRZ.com over to Alan. Wonder how long that's been there, Alan. And you should have told me sooner. You've been keeping all this a secret. KC2, Romeo, Foxtrot, November, K2RIW.
KC2RIW, KC2RFN. The reason I haven't been vocal is I'm using this this Yaesu FT270, which has a membrane over the microphone. I have to scream into it for anybody to hear me. So I'm sending the unit back, and I'm getting a new one, so I don't have to scream, and I can get online, get on the air a little more frequently. But I met you at the HRU, and the night before or the week before I had tuned into this TechNet, and you have a very unique voice, and you had asked a question that during one of the antenna sessions. I said, that's got to be that guy, and sure enough, it was you. And I thought it'd be worth taking a picture of interesting ham characters and throwing them up on my QRZ page. So I figured I'd spice mine up with some photographs. So it's been up there for a couple of weeks, and I just took over the website of the NASA account, the NASA Amateur Radio Club, and I'll be putting tons of photos up there and videos, things like that to bring us more online to hopefully attract some new hats. Back to you, Dick.
Comment.
Wesley recognized. Sounds to me like you were in the session on the subject of ham radio interference. I think that was one of the sessions where the speaker, either ham radio interference or one of the antenna sessions, like you said, where the speaker did say that he was doing something different than the recommendation of K2RIW or the TechNet, to which I raised my hand saying, yeah, you would have talked to that guy. And there was somebody sitting in front of me who said, yes, he recognized my voice, and it sounds like that was you. Very good. Nice meeting you, Alan, and keep up the good work. Wesley, go right ahead with your comment, and then we're going to have to pick up with Joe, and we have to make sure we don't time out the machine again so Joe can talk to us. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN for the TechNet. At first, the crash that you were mentioning about, it was not a chunk of ice. It was a piece of outer coating, very light one. It's a few grams only per square centimeters. And this was proven in the tunnel with the speed of the shuttle could literally burn the hole. And that's what is the problem with the coating, but not the piece of ice. So that's to correct you and to engineer.
Well, the amount of photography that he had from the Columbia incident was marginal. One of the cameras wasn't working. They knew approximately the size of the chunk of foam that broke off, and it was close to the size of an attaché case. When they did the testing on the ground, and they were using an air gun to shoot chunks of foam at the leading edge, their intention was to use chunks of dry foam at first to see if the right size of foam at the right velocity itself could damage the leading edge, the RCC, it was called, what is it called now, reaction carbon-carbon, the leading edge of this special material on the space shuttle wing. They intended to use dry pieces of foam of approximately the right size and the right velocity, shot at different angles in different portions of the leading edge. They were positive that was not going to create a failure, and then they were intending to proceed into small amounts of ice mounted within the foam, because it was a second day launch, and quite possibly there was ice within that foam. The surprise was that dry foam itself, with the outer coating, with no ice, was itself enough massive material at a high enough velocity that when it hits just right, could create the damage in the leading edge. That surprised the daylights out of everyone. They were positive they were going to pass the first tests, and they didn't. So whether the Columbia really had ice, and there is some evidence that ice does form on that particular chunk of foam that tends to break off from the external tank, that's still in question. That's the way I heard it, Wesley. And you're right. The test that created the failure on the ground was dry foam. N2XJN, K2RAW in the tech net.
Net tonight at 8 o'clock, W2VL, repeater system.
Okay, and to Jen. Yes, you're right, but I was wondering, how do they have to be very much cautious with the unexpected factors like a bird? The mass of the bird is much greater than the mass of the foam. How do they avoid this kind of accident? Back to you, Rick, and to Jen.
John, good question, Wesley, and I think I've got an answer for that. And I've got a very indirect answer. One of the aircraft that I worked on was the F-15 Eagle, F-15E aircraft, an extremely high-power fighter airplane. And the unique thing about an F-15 fighter airplane is that if you take it off from the runway and you're just barely flying, and you pull up elevator and aim the aircraft straight up and hit full throttle with afterburner, from essentially a standing start, the F-15 aircraft will rise in the air faster than the space shuttle rises in the air for the first 50,000 feet. For the first 50,000 feet, F-15 is faster. And the F-15 in pure vertical climb, when it's lightly loaded, it will break the speed of sound. Many aircraft will break the speed of sound when you put them in a dive. A few aircraft will break the speed of sound in level flight. The F-15 will break the speed of sound in pure vertical climb. My goodness, does that thing have a power-to-weight ratio. Let me drop. The velocity at which the air has to be moving to take a chunk of foam that breaks off from the external tank and accelerate that chunk of foam fast enough that when it impacts the wing, it can potentially do damage. The space shuttle is only moving that fast when it is at a pretty high altitude. I'm not sure of the exact altitude, but maybe the answer is 30,000 feet. That would be what, 40,000 kilometers? No, wait a minute. Divided by 3, roughly 10,000 kilometers. 10 kilometers or so. Only when the aircraft is, when the space shuttle is at that altitude, is it moving fast enough. The good news is that very few